This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. It's our first poetry show. We have poets, poetry, and talking about words and inspiration that leads to poetry. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is all about poetry. First up, poet Linda Russo. Andriette Piron spoke with poet and creative writer Linda Russo on February 10th, 2010. Linda is the author of Mirth, a full-length collection of poems. Her poetry and essays have been published in magazines and book collections. She teaches creative writing at Washington State University. Yet the common concern of most poets remains with Linda, and that's getting published. It's the first thing that comes to mind when she describes her professional life.
Gosh, I don't know. I feel like as a poet, I'm always trying to get published. You know, I mean, there's the writing part of it and engaging with it every day, or, you know, not every day, whatever my writing schedule happens to be. And, you know, writing out of the pleasure of either working with texts a lot. I work a lot with found materials, or I work a lot with what I call public language. Or so I work a lot with the radio on, or, you know, I've written lots of poems with the TV and, you know, Michael Pollan's talk, you know, people talking, poetry readings. I work a lot with the language that surrounds me and us, because I think language is really is a powerful way of defining, not only defining ourselves through speaking or choosing words, but that's it defines who we are culturally, you know. Mm-hmm. It's partly out of our control. Everything is ultimately laws, legislation, that's language. And I think it's important to listen to the language and think about what it means. So a lot of my writing time is spent listening and writing, and then working with the materials I've collected, more almost like a sculptor. Mm-hmm. than a poet, or, you know, putting the words together and listening to how they're coming together and seeing what kind of nuances come out of a particular combination. Do you know Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons? Mm-hmm. Like, I think of, you know, my poems have been described. I mean, these poems that I'm writing now, this doesn't describe all of my work, but, you know, my current poems tend to be pretty Steinian, and that the way they're not quite as abstract, because they do tend to have since they're working in a discourse that's already out there, they tend to reproduce or throw into question or defamiliarize a lot of the ideas that we're already surrounded with. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of it has to do with politics, you know, national and international politics. I have a piece called Swills that borrows a lot of language. This is more written language, but written language from, I was really fascinated for a while with the language of pharmaceutical warnings. You know, when you go to the drugstore and you pick up you have to have like this encyclopedia that comes with whatever drug you're taking. And I was really, really astounded with the kind of risks potentially people took when they're taking medications, if you really read mm-hmm. all the precautions and the kind of trust people put into the, the medical, people in the medical profession or the institution of Western medicine. And I think this piece kind of throws that into relief. But that was more working with written materials and putting them together in a way. So partly I work a lot with found language, but then there's a part of me that just sort of, especially in the summer in Pullman, I just sort of like to sit in my backyard mm-hmm. with a notebook and just notice, you know, just because this geographical environment is very new to me. So I like to use my poetry as a way of thinking about this bioregion, or thinking geographically, you know, thinking about the different things that exist, or the different the things that live and coexist here, or the different forces, even historical, human, and natural forces that kind of come together to make a place a place. Mm-hmm. So, and these are two very different sort of things, you know, that I do in my poetry, but so maybe I kind of switch back and forth. And
so it sounds like your current environment and your current surroundings and the current input that you're getting through media transforms into, you mm-hmm. change the language in such a way that it has meaning to you, or that you can find some kind of a message in it for yourself, at least, if nothing else, or explain something.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, though, that I'm actually a translator, like I take things and make them mean. I think of my poetry, especially the poetry that deals with language, I think that of that more as, I think of those poems as like little mirrors, like reflecting mirrors, so that you could look in and you could see an image and maybe not quite fully recognize it, but recognize something of what it is. So I really don't think of my those poems as creating a pretty transparent situation for the reader. I know that when the reader comes to them, they're kind of going to be like feeling sort of jostled around by the language. Mm-hmm. So those poems for me, it's much more about, it is about the sort of glints of meaning that come through. But I think that if we think that we are fully communicating, you know, with another individual without any disturbance in the signal, mm-hmm. like that's not really true. Mm-hmm. So my poetry doesn't set out to replicate a kind of communication setup that's a fantasy. Mm-hmm. It tries to be more like what language really does, mm-hmm. and the way we really hear things, and the levels of understanding, I suppose, even that we really have, but also this level of how powerful these public discourses are, and how we as individuals are kind of like, you know, observers, in a sense, of these larger discourses, if we bother to look at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how are they being received by people? You said a reader might feel a little jostled around. I'll have to admit, I felt that. You know, I read all the things that you sent me, and it seemed pretty disparate. In some ways, it's like it is. You know, and then I read the interview with you. And you said that your parents had read your book and that they loved it, and that, you know, and that your work is fairly accessible. And I wasn't sure it was all that accessible to me. And I don't know whether I'm missing something, or I don't know you well enough, or I haven't read enough of your poetry. But it didn't seem terribly accessible. It seemed more like what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it was more my mother. My father didn't. My father isn't a big reader. He's more of a media consumer, so maybe I get that partly from him. Mm. Of oral and video media, not print media, not so much print media. Mm-hmm. But my mother, I thought, you know, she was literally one of the first people to read the book when it was published, and she thought that it gave her insight into who I am. So, yeah, and I mean, in a sense, it's not that the poems are cryptic, I don't think. It's not like I try purposely to obscure who I am and try to make my poems inaccessible. But if you go into the poem looking for this identity or this coherent individual at the source of the poems, you're not really going to find that. Mm-hmm. So if you think of the poems as more of even collage poems.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. And some people, I think of the poems, I think of my poems as being, I call it switchy. Mm-hmm. Like they kind of switch back and forth, and they put things together so that when you read line by line, you feel like you're switching back, like switching between something and another thing, switchy. So,
And do you, when you're writing them, do you go the other way and put all the things together and then all the things and then jostle it all up again?
Oh, no, no. No, when I'm writing, I think because I write a lot through listening, you're always going to not catch everything. So it's not a purpose. It's not like I set out to purposefully create like a, like Boggle. I'm gonna like shake everything up and see where it falls. It's more that when I'm writing, I will take all of the language I got that was used to express a particular idea, and kind of recombine it in a way that I think is interesting and evocative, and maybe it retains some of the original meaning, but it could also kind of open up onto a different kind of meaning. I guess what I'm saying is, as a poet, my ultimate concern isn't that my reader understands something like that I'm trying to say.
Right.
It's more that they interact with the language and just say what is this language doing, and and what's interesting and pleasurable, and why not? I mean, what's problematic about what if I don't like it, why don't I like it? Mm-hmm. Just to sort of throw those assumptions about reading and meaning and communication into question.
Mm-hmm. You're really forcing the reader to be a part of the process and to be really looking at it for the beauty of the language, whatever it's throwing at you. How's that,
Yeah, I like the beauty of the language, but I would hope that that people would feel like they were, I guess, enabled rather than forced, because the reader always has the opportunity to, close the book, turn away from the poem.
Right.
I like that the beauty of the language, and
that's what struck me about your poetry is the way in which you put words together and sounds together, and the juxtaposition of what you're calling it switchy. It's in a way it's jarring, but it's not jarring in a negative way. It's like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Where you kind of like, oh, she put that with that,
It's, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Engaging.
Thank you. I mean, I hope it's not, I don't mean for it at all. I mean, I think this is probably evident, but I don't mean for my poetry to be contentless. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that I'm just putting words together because they sound cool together.
Right.
But that, part of the, the content in the poem for me is always, usually has something to do with identity and what is it to be, a citizen? What is it to be, what is it to be a woman? What is it, what is it to have this experience of being in this body, in this place, in this time? And so much of our experiences, I think, are spoken for us.
Mm-hmm.
So why should my poem, speak as though these experiences I'm having are actually mine? I mean, I feel like so much of, so many, let's say, possibilities for who I might be and what I might do are so, they're so transcribed by things that are out of my control,
mm-hmm.
Give
me an example.
Like concepts of what a woman does, or what a woman should do, or you could say sex roles or gender stereotypes, or I think a lot about how, as a citizen, how decisions are made, say, about foreign policy, and I might not agree with that individually, and yet in some sense I'm defined by that because I'm a constituent of this larger body of people called a nation that are making these decisions. So which is not to say that I'm not proud on some level of being an American, but that I feel like my identity is transcribed by people who have much more power to say what it is to be an American than I do. I don't try to ignore those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I try to kind of
mm-hmm.
write almost despite them.
We're listening to Andriette Piron's recent interview with poet Linda Russo. We'll be right back to hear some more of Linda's poetry. Thank you. The music is Lina Selyanina with what she calls piano poetry. When we took this break, Linda Russo was talking with Andriette Piron about her love of diction and language, as well as the current events that feed her poetry. Her words are juxtaposed in interesting and beautiful ways, and are picked and assembled like a collage from the auditory and visual input she experiences on a daily basis. As we rejoin the interview, Linda Russo reads her poem, Sparks Fly.
So sparks do really fly. It is not just a saying, sparks fly in an argument. Some in the intellectual resources industry say so. Words are powerful expression. For example, I am well. Love heals. I have seen it many times. Your face glows beneath the moon and its pink milk light. I thought to export more poems, to let the light and the chat embrace me like original software that can be corrupted, copied, and sold. Please, everyone, stop renting out your IQ and start creating. Embody your brain work. You can see it and feel it. It moves like liquid sunshine, a powerful simplicity, cutting billing costs, not skimping on time and materials. This is called distance healing. We have all seen love in action. We have all seen love in action. We have all seen love in action.
Beautiful.
So I think of that poem as kind of switching between this sort of very personal discourse, even of self-improvement, mm-hmm. and love and growth, and then this larger discourse of, you know, globalism, of this idea of renting out your brain work or producing, or a commercialism, like this other system in which we are all embraced, which has to do with how we earn our livelihoods, make money, but also interact with other people on a, you know, on a professional level. So this idea of embodying your brain work or renting out your IQ comes from this idea of intellectual property, you know, and that when you do work on someone else's clock, when you do creative work, it's not your own creative work. And well, there was another line in there that the intellectual resources industry. I mean, I was just so, mm-hmm. I was just, when I first heard that there was such a thing, an intellectual resources industry, I thought that was just really, really interesting to think about how we have industrialized intellection, mm-hmm. you know. And this particular poem came out of, I think, a radio program I was listening to on. For a while, I was really fascinated with India as the second largest democracy in this hugely growing economy, and I was reading The Economist kind of religiously, mm-hmm. and gathering a lot of information from the economy. So this poem sort of dipped into that discourse of, you know, of globalization, this idea of all the telecommunications centers we have overseas. I don't know, it just seems like, you know, you said disparate, you know, when you start really thinking about it, it seems like there are so many people who need something to do, you know, who need some livelihood, and, you know, we create these bigger and bigger things to absorb all these people's work, but where does all that work go? This was, you know, this poem became kind of a plea for people to, you know, embody your brain work, to kind of bring it back down to the local level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, probably is very influenced anyway by my being here, because there is a very strong sense of localism in the Palouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a lot of brain work being embodied. I mean, this isn't a large industrial center by any means, so.
And it's kind of an intellectual resource center.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
We've got a lot of the intellectual resources right here between the two universities and
yeah.
the communities. And
yeah, exactly. So
cool.
So this wasn't really a poem about, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's not really about nationalism or feeling one's sense as a citizen, but I think, you know, being a citizen simply means having a sense of obligation to the things that you're building with other people as a community. I mean, citizenship is community. It's mm-hmm. not just some political ideal, or mm-hmm. I don't want to sound like I'm a anti-nationalist or anti-American or anything like that. But
no, it almost sounds the opposite, really, that you're quite interested in being, you know, and what that means to be a citizen.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. To be where you are, mm-hmm. and do what you're doing, but to not lose scope of the idea that America plays a huge role, you know, on a global scale. Well, here's a poem I wrote in Oklahoma. I wrote it for my partner, Kirk, because we lived there together for a little while, and it's called Watch and Warning. This poem tells about tornado watch and warning, such as rotation, drop down, power flashes, storm track, trees down, straight line winds, respect, west-facing windows. It leaves an area to the northeast and becomes another kind of storm, windy, very windy, 100 miles per hour, taking cover, abandoning mobile homes, piling mattresses, lifting off to the northeast. We watch it and listen and say the only escape mechanism is to keep it purely conceptual. More a poem about an experience of living in a place, and but I guess there is that element of the local and all this language, and you know, when you grow up in Oklahoma, you know all this stuff.
Yeah.
And when you live there and you first encounter it, you're like, what? You have to pile up mattresses? You got to have a bicycle helmet handy? You know, like this whole, what's familiar, you know, this what's familiar to other people is extremely unfamiliar to you as a kind of outsider. But that poem also, I think, is about the awesome power of nature and, you know, respect is one of the words yeah. that comes into that poem. So respect both for people who live and grow into a place, you know, some locals, the Okies, and a respect for nature as this force. And the closing lines of that poem, anyway, the only response is to keep it purely conceptual, is this idea that, you know, we never realized, I mean, the tornado never became a real phenomenon for us. It was something we would watch on TV, and you know, you'd be glued to the TV because you'd be watching a tornado mm-hmm. move across the state, and you'd be wondering if you were going to be affected at all. And you know, oh my God, now when do I have to start worrying about getting the cats into the basement? Like, so in a sense, it was purely conceptual because we were watching it on TV.
Right.
You know, so there. I guess the theme is, I mean, there's still that theme of. What's at a distance, and even media, and how media brings things really close to us, and even the kind of language, how language conveys or constructs an experience.
Linda Russo teaches creative writing at Washington State University in Pullman. She spoke with Andriette Piron about the importance of place, time, language, politics, community, and the role of the media in her poetry. The Urban Roots Band, Po Girl, is Allison Russell, Benny Seidlinger, and Anna Tejeda. Allison, she goes by Allie, and Anna head the band and write the songs. This one is Deer in the Night. It's musical poetry written by Allie.
Sometimes
spoke with Po Girl at the Moscow Food Co-op while they were touring the Northwest. I spoke with them about songwriting. Here's Anna Tejeda.
It's basically like whoever writes the song or whatever sings the lead. We've yet to do like where I'll write a song and she sings the lead on it, which we should. It would be an interesting project, kind of like. But yeah, we mostly just sing our own songs
and then sing harmonies. We've co-written some songs, but I guess it's mostly where I've sung lead on our co-writes. Although that is not in any way set. Nothing is set in stone. It's constantly evolving and changing. And Anna and I are both really prolific these days. And Benny has been writing a bunch of stuff, and I'm trying to convince him that he needs to start presenting it to the band as well. He's an incredible arranger and everything, but he hasn't yet. We haven't been able to convince him yet, but we'll see.
You haven't been able to convince him to sing his songs?
Sing them or to present them, either to sing them himself or to present them to us to sing, either way. We haven't been able to convince him yet, but we'll see.
There's a better chance of them convincing me to present them for them to sing. I'll say that.
I'm really curious about the process of songwriting, being somebody who doesn't really do that. How do you find your topics? And then talk to me about how it becomes a song, and it may be different for each of you.
Well, I think that anything is fair game in terms of a topic. I think basically that's the way that I process the world and my feelings about the world is through songwriting and always has been. I guess it started more with poetry in my case because I didn't think of myself as a musician for a long time. Probably really until I was around 17, 18, I started to actually think of myself as a musician. I think basically whatever you would, I think maybe in some ways it might be similar for you to how you decide to do a piece about something or what you're curious about that week and want to explore more. I think that is really similar to the way that I approach songwriting. And usually I don't necessarily think of, oh, I want to do a song about horseback riding, I'm going to write this song. It's more just whatever happens to be brewing and bubbling in my psyche that ends up coming out in song form at some point or another.
But does it start with words or with a feeling that's expressed musically?
I think it varies. Actually, that's a great question. Sometimes it does start with words, sometimes it starts with feeling, sometimes it starts with a melody that words kind of form around later on. It really is, there's no one way for me that songs develop, and sometimes I have to really struggle for them. Sometimes I have a fragment of an idea and I work on it for a bit and I get discouraged and it lies dormant for a while, and then maybe even a year later I'll kind of find the other components that make the song, and sometimes I'll write something that doesn't make the cut for what gets presented to the audience or even to my band, depending on the fragment.
When you're writing a song and you know you have all these instruments that you all play to choose from, do you also hear it with the various instrumentation, or does that come later too?
That kind of comes later. Sometimes I'll have a really strong idea, and I think for Anna it's similar, but often it's we present it to the group, and Benny will often have great ideas as to what instruments we should use, or arrangements, or tightening up the form or the structure, or you know, melodic ideas within the song, rhythmic ideas. Those things really evolve together with the three of us working on it, and it just really evolves that way.
I want to ask you same basic question, just songwriting. How does the process work for you?
All of what Allie just said is very true for me as well. I think in the last few years even 2 years, I've been taking myself more seriously as a writer, which I never did before. Most of my career has been kind of backing up other people. Same with Allie. And so lately, I've been like, I have been doing like, well, I don't have a breakup song, or like I'm gonna write that, or I'll try like writing exercises where it's not necessarily coming from a feeling or just out of me, I'm trying to force it, or you know, just to keep it moving in me, so it's never kind of stops, which that's been interesting and painful, and those kind of songs that I end up writing mostly are the ones that really don't make the cut. It's the ones that kind of just seem to come out of nowhere, like I'm almost like a gateway from somewhere else. I have no idea within 15 minutes there's an entire song written, and those ones seem to be the ones that are most true.
Here's Poe Girl with Gandhi Dancer, written by Anna Tejeda.
Got nothing to do but roll around heaven all day. Gandhi Dancer, Gandhi Dancer, Gandhi sits there low, where the boat lands in a naughty show. Works like a dog for the nickel and dime. For promise means nothing when stolen and dragged down the line. Gonna dance, gonna dance.
You can hear more from Poe Girl at www.pogirl.net. That's P-O-G-I-R-L.net. You're listening to Yin Radio's Poetry Show. Next up, poets Sean Hill and Elizabeth Bradfield. While on fellowships with Stanford University, Sean Hill and Elizabeth Bradfield toured the Pacific Northwest together doing poetry readings. The collection they read at the University of Idaho in 2009 focused on place. They call it Terra Firma. Here's Sean Hill.
Terra Firma, sort of the solid earth beneath us, the landscapes that we call home and write from and wrestle with. And for me, that's, you know, Milledgeville, Georgia, this little town that used to be the capital of the great state of Georgia. This first book of mine, I write about the history of that place, and I share a little bit of that with you. This first poem is about the Black Business District that was thriving earlier in the 20th century, and then as a result of the mall coming to Milledgeville and desegregation, it failed. But at one point it was a thriving place. Nigger Street, 1937. Macintosh Street, the sign reads, like the apple, red, but not red delicious red, but red like red-eyed gravy on grits at Gus's, or red like stoplights, but they're also green and yellow, like apples in Allen's Market on the corner, and red like those syrups and powders kept behind the counter at Doc's Pharmacy, and red like stoked coals or embers, red in Saul's Forge, and red like the stripe on Richard's barber pole and the stitching around buttonholes of overalls of those coming to town on Saturdays, and red like the three ball, solid red in the side pocket at the Blue Moon, and red like the eyes of those late staying patrons early in country churches on Sunday mornings, and in church, the red of the edge of white pages in a black-bound Bible coming together, closing, red as the congregation rises. This next poem, it's a haibun, which is a Japanese form. It's a prose poem that's followed by a haiku. As I read it, I'll read the big prose chunk first, and then I'll pause for the haiku. This is a story about domestic violence, ultimately. It comes from Milledgeville, but I guess it's not only a Milledgeville story. Milledgeville High Bun. Beat, beat, beats, beat here. The sound of the train on the Georgia Road, the measured claps of the wheels, the gaps of the joints of the rails, is the beat of the hammer on iron and anvil at the smithy, Saul's shop, shaping shoes for mules and horses. And the sizzle of red metal in water is the train's whistle, and all echoes resound and diffuse. And the last word returns like watermelons here, with summer heat, beat with a hammer, beat when he, a boy, broke into the garden at the county jail at night when the beat men were asleep, because theirs were the sweetest. So bust one open. The dull thud just before the crack, and eat the heart, and move on to the next. And he moved on to women, and settled eventually on one, and finally busted her with finality. Thud before crack. And he measured time, raising the sweetest watermelons for a time. And time served, he returned. And he lay on the tracks of the Georgia Road, cradled by the rails. Heart stopped. Old railroad, abandoned. Between cross ties, trees grow. A feral pig roots below branches. So this next poem came out of a bit of research. I was reading the old newspapers in Milledgeville and came across an article about an airplane flying overhead. It was the first time that an airplane flew over the city. This was 1917. And it was an army airplane, a military airplane, flew over the city. And so I wrote a poem. Auspice. The world must be made safe for democracy. Woodrow Wilson, April 2nd, 1917. This late May morning, spring spills into summer, warm as a bath in a tin tub, where ivory soap floats for those who can afford it. White as clouds or cotton, graying water, the same as lye soap, homemade, brownish yellow, speckled with white flecks, fat boiled together with ashes collected after the smoke has gone up to the wide sky. The wind crawls through treetops, oaks, elms, and pines. Leaves sift sound as limbs groan and creak. Crepe myrtle blossoms blush dust devils. They glide across swept yards and dirt roads. Mockingbirds find the highest perches and sing, while quiet turkey buzzards ride the rising heat above all. A drone like wasps on the breeze, or hens beating themselves down from low branches, roosts they'd yearned for yesterday. For the first time under heaven, men fly over Milledgeville, flying at angles to navigate. They will soon go to war. In boats bound for France, colored soldiers cross the slate ocean. I usually introduce this next poem by saying it's about a ham. And it is about a ham, but it's also about injustice. The story behind this is that when I was reading the old newspapers, I found an article that was sort of a success story, that's the way it was pitched, about a man who had been sentenced to 14 years, actually no, 20 years, he only served 14, sentenced to 20 years for stealing a ham. And so I wanted to sort of explore what that would be like, where that would leave a person. So I wrote a poem. It's my response to everything. Mm-hmm. Uncle John. That was the year Granddaddy Thomas died, left the family worse than broke. Uncle John stole a ham from Mr. Enos's meat market. He was 17, lost his taste for it, locked up. 14 years. Ham, salt cured and earth red, sliced with the fat hanging on. Yellow sunshine on a white plate. The ham bone cut crosswise, rings marrow. A dark eye, all in the skillet, making gravy for grits. Lost his taste for all things salt. The ocean he hasn't seen, woman and man. He don't never want to see no more ham on his plate. Was hard for him. Hates pigs. Hates white folks too. Time off for good behavior. They didn't hold him till the last six. He's a hog farmer. Only eats beef and chicken and turkey. Fish, turtle and rabbit. Squirrel, possum and coon. And he seasons his greens with smoked oxtails. Can't raise white folks for slaughter. Now, Liz Bradfield.
Again, as Sean said, this is our terra firma section of the reading tonight. And There's an interesting essayist named David Gessner, and he wrote a book called Sick of Nature, which is always an interesting title. But he has an essay in there where he talks about being what he calls a polygamist of place, Having more than one place that you feel loyalty to, more than one place that you feel connected to. And I agree with him. I feel very much connected to the landscape of the Pacific Northwest where I grew up. I grew up in Tacoma. And I've totally fallen in love with Alaska and with Cape Cod, where I've lived for a number of years. So I want to read some poems from these places. And the first is called Echoing, although I didn't know it at the time I wrote it, David's book. It's called No More Nature, and it takes place primarily out on Cape Cod. And I think there's only one term I need to define here. I talk about blackfish, and blackfish is another term for the shortfin pilot whale, a really cool toothed whale that is large for a dolphin, small for a whale, that sometimes will strand in groups on the shore, particularly on Cape Cod. No more nature. No more nature, we say after 14 hours on the water in August, skin ready to crack, lips too tender to close. No more nature in November when blackfish strand in the salt marsh, and we've stood in sulfur muck as the tide falls out to dark, their breath whistling hard as we dig pits for flippers scraped raw by sand, as vets try to predict which could survive until flood, which should get the syringe of chemical sleep. No more nature after the storm blows up while guiding kayakers across the bay, which means towing home the shoulder injury, prow lunging the chop, tow rope cinching the gut. No more nature after waking before dawn to banned birds in first frost, shin after shin ringed with numbered metal, wing after wing teased from nets until we almost forget how frightened their small hearts made us when we first held them. No more. We can't take it, can't resuscitate our wonder, can't keep up with its unrelenting. But then we have a beer. We take a shower. We decide to walk around the pond and look for turtles. After all, we could see a coyote lapping its reflection. We could find the nest of the great horned owl that calls each night as we lie in bed, unable to not listen, unwilling to miss anything. In thinking about place and what makes a place home, I tend to turn toward natural history and toward biology. I was visiting my parents moved to Seattle a number of years ago, and I was visiting them. And they live on Magnolia, and I was thinking about the trees there, and I was thinking about how the place got its name. It says it in the poem, but I'll just, sometimes it's hard to catch things in poems, but George Vancouver, when he was coming along the West Coast and mapping this area, he came to Seattle and he saw the bluff of Magnolia by Elliott Bay, and he saw the big trees there, the Madrona trees, and he thought they were magnolias. He misnamed them. So ever since, the neighborhood has been misnamed, and so I was stricken by that. This is called Succession. In the neighborhood called Magnolia, they've planted magnolia trees to right an old mistake made when George Vancouver's crew saw thick-leaved madronas on bluffs over Elliott Bay and misnamed them. Magnolia trees outside the coffee shop, magnolia trees, native to this continent but not its northwest coast, land of cedar and salal. They are leafed out, staked up witness to our desire for truth-making. Outside the post office on Magnolia, magnolias. Magnolias glossy and tended by the antique store, fenced in a sidewalk by the bus stop. Meanwhile, the madronas, whose peeling trunks, burnt orange and sleek, colors layering from Granny Smith to pomegranate, papery with curls I've peeled and scrawled, here since the last glaciation, slow-growing and picky, waste away in neighborhood parks while beautification committees worry and try, unable to hear what for madronas is truth. What the tree wants is burning, to burn among huckleberry and Oregon grape, then bud from the leftover roots, moldered by lawn and dogs and all we've brought with us to make things nice. The madronas wait for lightning, for some untended spark, to argue their need against our clipped and tended ideas of care. Then I wanted to read an Alaska poem, but I was going through the book and thinking again about that idea of home and place and how we connect ourselves to place. Moving up to Alaska, I instantly wanted it to be home, but it wasn't exactly. And that idea of ownership of a spot, I don't know how many of you are new to Idaho in particular, but when you fall in love with a place and feel incredibly invested, but also are very aware of your newness to a spot, it's an interesting tension. So I wanted to try and write into that. This poem is called Splitters and Joiners. And for the biologists in the audience, you are familiar with this, I'm sure, but it ties to the idea of how you define a species. Some biologists traditionally have been splitters, splitting out animals into smaller and smaller categories of species. Others have been joiners, lumping them all together. At one point, instead of Ursus arctos, instead of the grizzly bear, we have one species, there were over 100 species of what now is one species. So there's been dramatic shifts over time. I was interested in that. Splitters and joiners. All the sparrows and their modelings, the adaptable gulls breeding across category, how do we tell them apart? Or the new world tyrants, willow and alder flycatchers, so alike that only song separates them? We separate them. The old arguments beat against air, scientists on either side, splitters and joiners. Which best serves truth? That there are more kinds, or that the two are close enough to call species, call same? This morning in Maine, the dove tells me, also sad, sad, sad. Calling in this place among places I can't call home, having left too quickly, having left even while joined, discovering Bashan, Duwamish, Stellwagen, Chugach. Allow me to be responsible to you, to see how you are linked, even if unearned by years or birth. Allow me to consider which, separate, same, will best serve this patch of cranberry, salal, this stand of shore pine, madrona. Rock dove, pigeon, linked in field guides, but what difference between rooftop and wild field? Blue grouse split this year's to dusky and sooty because we noticed something new. They are joined to us, separate from these birds with their own stories and associations, flying through the groupings we imagine and impose, not unaffected, though, by the long, strange echoes of their names.
Elizabeth Bradfield and Sean Hill read their poetry at the University of Idaho in 2009. Liz has published two books of poetry and runs a grassroots press, Broadsided Press. You can learn more about her work and about her at www.ebradfield.com. Sean has been published in many journals and anthologies. His first book, Blood Ties and Brown Liquor, was published in 2008 by the University of Georgia Press. More about and by Sean Hill is at www.seanhill.org, seanhill.org. Now, Poe Girl's going to wrap up this poetry show with the song How the Poet Goes. It's written by Allie Russell.
We might as well lift up the glass. We might as well rejoice in random chance and take our pleasure while we can, 'cause we'll be gone real soon. Sweet daffodils like sentinels, mad magpies try to tease the crows. Now think of how the poet goes, and we'll be gone real soon. We'll be gone real soon. We'll be gone real soon. The stars are dead, you're the moon, love are gone real soon. We crave and sing, we fight and cry. We are never, never satisfied. Full but heart tied out. Is this how the romance stops? When the moment never comes and we'll be gone real soon. We'll be gone.
You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive our electronic newsletter or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho by VP Foundation and by me. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next week.
We're waltzing high upon a wind. We'll be gone real soon. We sing, love is everything, love is everything. Love is everything.